Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, on the fourth anniversary of the previous Pope's death, we remember Pope John Paul II through the eyes of both a bishop and a young Australian missionary. Plus, as the G20 summit gathers pace in London, we take a look at the hopes and expectations of a British government minister and a Zambian priest dedicated to promoting economic justice and development. Benedict XVI celebrated a special Mass in St. Peter's Basilica on Thursday, marking the fourth anniversary of the death of his predecessor, John Paul II, who died on the evening of April 2, 2005. Among those taking part in the Mass were a crowd of young people from the Rome Diocese, preparing to celebrate World Youth Day on this Palm Sunday, an event which will include a symbolic handing over of the World Youth Day cross and icon from Sydney, Australia, to Madrid, where the next major international youth gathering will be held in 2011.
I think John Paul II had a vision, and he could really see that youth draw so much strength from being together.
Australian Annalise really Wursthorn is currently studying in Rome at the Emmanuel School of Mission. But last year she spent 6 months travelling around Australia with the World Youth Day cross and icon ahead of the July celebrations in Sydney. She came into our studios this week to reflect on the legacy of Pope John Paul II, especially to young Catholics all over the world.
Yeah, John Paul II was such a special pope, especially for young people. And as the founder of World Youth Day, I mean, for me, he was very special. I guess my lasting memories I have of him, I had a very special experience in 2004. I was in Rome for a youth forum. It was actually Palm Sunday, and I don't know why, but for some reason I was asked if I would like to receive communion from him. So, of course, I did. And so that Mass was very special. I remember walking up the aisle to receive communion from him and kneeling down and looking into his eyes. And I really was so overcome because I felt like I was looking into Christ's eyes and that he was looking right into my soul. And I thought, I mean, at the time I didn't really wasn't able to think about what was going on. It was just a very special spiritual moment for me. But I think as I reflected on it in the last few years, I've really come to realize that it was through his holiness he gave himself so much to God's will and to what he was asked to do, that he was even able to give his eyes to Christ, and Christ was able to look at people through his eyes. And he just had this love, and I really felt like he knew me. And I know that's ridiculous because he doesn't know me, but I felt like he could see right into my soul. And I think that was just a testimony to how holy he was and how in tune with Christ he was.
Despite the fact that at this point he was really quite elderly, really struggling with his illnesses.
Yes, and his frailty really struck me too, because I think there's a tendency of all of us with other famous people too, not just the Pope, but to really imagine them as superhuman or some strong other person. But I was so struck by his humanness. Just, I remember looking at him thinking, he's just an old man. And that really, not in a bad sense, but in the sense of he is a normal person, and this is what he's done with his life. And that we are really called, we're all normal too, and I know I'm normal, but I'm really called to try and live something amazing, because that's what God's plan is for me and for all of us.
He had a very special charisma with young people, didn't he? What do you think that was due to?
I really don't know. There's some amazing footage of him dancing with young people, and I guess because of my age, I wasn't able to see him in the prime of his life. And so I do rely on other people's testimony and on some older videos. And I love this, there's a specific one that I really love where he's walking past a crowd of young people and he just puts his cape over the top of them. And it looks so mischievous. And he just had a real special love for the young people. And I think he really believed in us. And that's what came through when he gave us the World Youth Day Cross. He could really see that the young people were not this wayward generation that nothing could be done. He really saw that we were full of life, full of all the gifts of the Holy Spirit, and that we were able to and really called to embrace this faith. And I think by doing that, he really empowered young people to really take on responsibility and to say, yeah, I'm a Christian and I'm going to do something about it. And it's not a church for older people. It's a church for me and it's my church, and it's a church for people of all ages.
And we saw those extraordinary scenes of while he was dying and then at his funeral of, again, a crowd of every nation and every age group, but especially of young people.
Dominican Bishop Anthony Fisher is an auxiliary in the Diocese of Sydney, and as the youngest Australian church leader, he was charged with coordinating World Youth Day 2008. He also reflects for us now on the lasting impact of the previous Pope on the so-called John Paul II generation.
I think undoubtedly he will be remembered as a Pope for youth, as well as many other things. He was a wonderful teacher and communicator, a great actor on the world stage, a great fighter for causes such as life in the womb and the family and justice for the third world. But certainly his love for young people, the images that we see it on our imaginations and memories of him dancing with young people at World Youth Days, of making faces, making the shape of glasses or binoculars at the young people and so on. These are things we'd never seen before in popes, this very natural and immediate connection he had with young people and they had with him, and that remarkably survived even when he became very frail and very sick. Young people then sort of adopted him as their sick grandfather. It wasn't that they hid from him or lost interest because he was no longer able to dance with them. They walked with him, and we saw those extraordinary scenes of while he was dying and then at his funeral of, again, a crowd of every nation and every age group, but especially of young people who really regarded him as their Pope. Now, of course, for many of them, he's the only Pope they ever knew. They were too young to have known John Paul I or Paul VI or anyone before. Now there are young people growing up for whom John Paul will be history and who've only known Benedict. And so there's people talk of the B16 generation, just as people spoke before of the John Paul II generation. But certainly that John Paul II generation now are emerging in roles of leadership and service in the church and in the wider community. And they carry with them, I think, a very particular stamp of his pontificate, his enthusiasm for the sorts of causes I've mentioned. That those young people, now not so young as they become young adults and eventually middle-aged, carry some of those ideals with them.
Alleluia, receive the power from the Holy Spirit.
A particular memory I have of one time I met him, though I'm a Sydney boy and now I'm back in Sydney as a bishop, at that time I was working in Melbourne, and I was introduced to him then as a, not as a bishop, just as a priest. And the group that introduced me said, oh, this is Father Anthony Fisher, he's from Melbourne, Australia. And John Paul looked at them and very mischievously said, oh, Melbourne, I remember Sydney. And of course, he knew very well this traditional rivalry between the two big cities in Australia. And to say this to Melbourneers would be a cause of perhaps some annoyance and certainly amusement. But he was teasing us. And likewise, years later, when I was a bishop, I met him towards the very end of his life. And he said to me, he knew I was a religious, I was a Dominican. He said, how many young new religious are there in Australia now? And I said, very few. And he said, and how many kangaroos? And I thought this was a very strange question. I wondered if maybe his medication was affecting him or why his mind was wandering. And I said, well, as I understood, there were about 80 million kangaroos, about, I think, 4 kangaroos for every one person in Australia. And he said, ah, yes, I want as many new young religious as there are new kangaroos. That set me quite a goal for the years ahead. in Australia.
Thanks there to Dominican Bishop Anthony Fisher, Auxiliary in the Diocese of Sydney. And earlier you heard Australian Annalise Wursthorn, currently studying at the Emmanuel School of Mission here in Rome. Put people first was the cry of tens of thousands of demonstrators who took to the streets of London at the weekend ahead of the G20 summit, which opened there amid tight security on Thursday. An estimated 35,000 demonstrators from around 150 charities, NGOs and unions joined in the peaceful protest organised by the Put People First Alliance. Their message to leaders of the world's wealthy nations was to take responsibility for the current financial crisis and come up with more just economic policies that will benefit the poor and tackle pressing issues of climate change and fair trade regulations. Well, ahead of this key summit in London, I went to the House of Commons to talk with Gareth Thomas, Minister of State for the UK's Department for International Development, which oversees the British government's efforts to fight poverty in the developing world. He told me the British government under Gordon Brown is committed to keeping the rights and the needs of the poorer nations under the spotlight at this meeting.
Well, what we want from the G20 summit is agreement that the major international financial institutions will, as well as trying to help rich nations such as our own adjust and recover from the financial crisis, make sure that they're also looking at the needs of developing countries. One of the major lessons from previous financial crises is that it is the poor who suffer most. So as well as putting more money into banking systems, we also need to make sure that we're providing targeted help so that the very poorest can get access to benefits and other immediate help, job assistance programs in a way that weren't provided in previous financial crises to help stop people getting into more difficulties and the numbers of people in poverty increasing.
These ambitious goals are all laid out in the Millennium Development Goals manifesto, and yet over halfway through we seem to be falling well behind achieving those targets by 2015. Do you share that assessment, first of all, and if so, who is to blame?
I don't think the assessment is quite as gloomy as you present. We're certainly off track to meet the Millennium Development Goals in a number of countries, and we're certainly off track to meet particular goals in particular countries. And there is no question that the international community, along with developing countries, developing country governments, it's got to be a partnership. We've all got to do more. What is clear, I think, is that the current financial crisis creates the risk that we will go backwards in terms of the fight to meet the Millennium Development Goals. And that's why the G20 summit is so important for trying to release more money from the international financial institutions to make sure that doesn't happen.
Britain has pledged to reach its commitment to the 0.7 target by 2013. Is that still on track?
Yes, Gordon Brown has reconfirmed our determination to reach 0.7 by 2013. What we obviously will want to use the G20 summit to do is to try to encourage all those other big nations who made promises back in 2005 at Gleneagles to follow through on those promises, despite the difficulties that we recognise that everybody's facing at the moment.
Gareth Thomas there, Minister of State for the UK's Department for International Development. Among the faith-based groups taking part in the Put People First Alliance and keeping a close eye on the London summit is CAFOD, the Catholic Agency for Overseas Development. Hundreds of their supporters joined other Christians at an ecumenical prayer service in London ahead of Saturday's demonstration. Their aim was to highlight the devastating impact of the economic crisis on the poor in the developing world. One of the speakers at that service was Zambian priest and Secretary General of the Zambian Bishops' Conference, Father Joe Koma-Koma. He talked to my colleague Chris Altieri about the message he wanted to get across to the G20 leaders.
Our concerns for the G20 summit is that the current economic crisis is hitting the poorest countries hardest. And Zambia is an example of that. Zambia depends on copper mining for most of its foreign earnings. And because of the economic crisis, the mines are being closed. And so far we've lost 3,000 jobs, and we are hearing from Zambia that in the next few weeks, this number may rise to 10,000 jobs lost. And this, in our understanding, is that it worsens the poverty situation that already exists. And we have then people who fail to afford a decent meal a day. We'll have people who have no money to pay for education and health. We'll have people who have no proper access to housing. So it will worsen the poverty situation that's already serious in poor countries.
What sort of things would you have the G20 members keep in mind as they address the economic crisis?
Our concern is that they may end up just looking at things from their own perspective. And so far we have heard in many countries where they are putting together stimulus packages that benefits the rich countries only. But this economic crisis is having an impact on the poorer countries, and we want the G20 to be conscious of that, that the decisions they make have an impact on the poor countries, and we want them in their discussions to consider the plight of the poor countries, because this economic crisis especially is not the making of the poor countries. So we want them to come and support the poor countries to cope with this crisis. And we are asking for greater justice, and that's why we want our voice to be heard around, and that we should be at the table. And we are told that the AU has been given a seat, but it's more or less ad hoc. Would want that seat to be permanent so that the African voice is forever present when these rich countries are meeting, so that the concerns that we have are always brought to the table.
Now, there is a tendency among many of the, perhaps even the best intentioned of people who are involved in aid projects and work with countries in the developing world, to look on the world's poorest countries as liabilities. Is there a sense in which, in order to resolve this crisis, the rich nations of the world need perhaps to change their way of viewing the poor countries?
The biggest concern, even for the rally that is, and the other demonstrations that are being held in the UK, coinciding with the G20 meeting, is that what we want is greater justice. And that, you know, global injustice should be tackled. The poor countries are not liabilities, but what is normally forgotten is that, you know, conditionalities are given by the rich countries when they come to the aid of poor countries. What we want are conditionalities from below, because we from the poor countries know exactly what we want. Sometimes the conditionalities given by the rich countries block development. Zambia, again, is a case in point. The IMF and the World Bank, you know, put pressure on our government in Zambia, to sign what we called the development agreements with major mining companies, because they said we needed to open up our economy to foreign investment, thereby enhancing development. This we did. Now, 3 years down the line, because of the economic crisis, these big mining countries are packing up their bags and closing mines. And the development that was promised, because we thought they would be there for the long haul, but of course they are only interested in profits. And then they are closing their mines and going elsewhere. And we remain with the economic problems that we have. Now, if the IMF and World Bank would have listened to our government in terms of their concerns, then maybe some of these shocks would have been taken care of.
With development, there also needs to come diversification, doesn't there? In other words, as long as it's a question of just exploiting the natural resources of the country, you're going to end up with a situation in which real, true development doesn't take place, does it?
Yes, and that is the role of civil society in countries like Zambia, from the poor countries. And we are here representing that civil society. While we are bringing our concerns to the G20, back home we also have a responsibility. And that responsibility is that we hold our own governments to account, that we want them to put in place sound economic programs. And we've been insisting that they should diversify. And this is another example of them simply depending on this mono economy of copper mining. And when there's a big shock like we have now, it has a knock-on effect because it affects the other sectors of the economy. So we've been putting pressure on government to invest in agriculture and to invest in other social services that could create jobs away from the mining sector. And this way we could assure long-term development. And this is an ongoing thing that we do. And sometimes I think the activities of civil society in the South is not sufficiently covered in the northern media. But we are very active, like the church itself is very active in Zambia in raising its voice about, you know, social development that, you know, would depend on homegrown programs and not always waiting for the IMF and the World Bank to dictate what happens.
You talk about the worldwide economic crisis being created by systemic inequities and iniquities in the world economic structure. And at the same time, you're encouraging the countries, the rich countries of the world, who are largely responsible for creating this crisis, to meet their promises to the poor nations, which sounds like continuing on the same path that sort of got us here.
The point I was making is this, that, you know, the current crisis has been caused by problems that, as you said, the systemic in the way we've been doing our business, in the way we've run the world economic order, if you want. And if these problems have come from the rich countries, then they have a responsibility to help those who suffer the consequences most, like the poor countries, to cope with the crisis. If they just seek solutions for themselves and leave the poor countries who are now suffering because of no fault of their own, like the government of Zambia, which was put under pressure by the IMF and the World Bank. And behind the IMF and the World Bank are the rich countries. Now, when they were put under pressure to sign the development agreements that brought in all this big, huge foreign investment in the mines, and the mining companies are going out, then it is the responsibility of the rich countries to ensure that countries like Zambia are assisted to cope with the consequences of the economic decisions that were made.
Despite the massive, even though temporary, foreign investment in the mining industry in Zambia, corresponding improvements in the living conditions and standards of living among the people who were employed in the mines were not forthcoming. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, because of the nature of the development agreements that were signed with the mining companies, where they have the freedom to take out 100% of the profits that they make without having a certain percentage of those profits reinvested back in the country. They have very little social responsibility in terms of some of the effects of their activities. You know, mining companies by nature are polluting, and they pollute a lot, and they don't pay a big price for the pollution that they cause. So these are some of the conditionalities we want to come from below, that, you know, if then a company comes and invests in a country like Zambia, then they should at least reinvest part of their profits in the country so that the country can benefit from the activities. But where they just come and make their profits and leave, that is unacceptable. That is not justice. The government had to sit down with these mining companies and renegotiate some of the agreements within, some of the details within the development agreements, like raising some tax, you know, the basic tax, you know, for mining, the royalty tax, from 0.6% to 3%. Of course, I mean, the mining companies were not amused by that. But if again, I can give you an example on the copper mining in the last few years. The price of copper, when the mining companies were signing agreements with the government, was about £3,000 a ton. Now the price rose to £6,000, and yet, when they started, you know, benefiting from the windfall profits, there was no corresponding windfall tax. So they made huge profits in the 2 years that the prices remained high. Now the prices are back around £3,000 a ton. But now they are closing the mines, and yet they are within the same price, you know, at which they were making the agreements. But just because they're interested in the huge profits, then they don't want to stay and, you know, stick it until maybe this problem is over. Then we can clearly see that, you know, the benefits that should accrue to the local people will not be forthcoming because the big mining companies are not investing in the local economy as they should.
Doesn't there have to be, on a local level, with the Zambian government, good, well-crafted pollution laws and also the means to enforce those laws, regulatory commissions and such? And is there a way that rich nations and poor nations could work in partnership to craft that sort of legislation and to create that sort of safeguard, if you will?
Exactly. These are the kind of things we'd want to see as we engage in global trade, because naturally, the poor countries are in a very weak position to negotiate with these powerful, powerful institutions like these big mining companies. And pollution is an example. There are laws in Zambia, but to enforce them against such big, powerful mining companies, the threat usually from the mining companies is that, oh, your rules are too strict and we are going to move our investment elsewhere, because then the investment environment in your country is not conducive. They use that kind of flowery language. But if there was an agreement that wherever they go, they will have similar stringent laws against pollution, then it puts the poorer countries in a stronger position to negotiate. But now I think the mining companies and other big international institutions play the poor countries one against the other by always threatening that we shall move to the next country or we shall take this investment somewhere if you are not interested. And because you are poor and you really need that investment in order to give a bit of a lift to your economy, you end up signing something that may not be in your interest. And this is exactly what has happened with Zambia with the big mining companies.
I'd like to go back to some of the things that the Holy Father said when he was in Africa. One of the most poignant, I think, was that the economic crisis, the global economic crisis, is the result of a spiritual bankruptcy and that what is required is a moral and spiritual renewal. How is it that moral and spiritual renewal could concretely affect the kinds of changes that the structures, that the broken structures of the world economy require?
This is where the role of the church and the church institutions and, you know, church groups like CAFOD, which invited us to come here, church groups like ourselves in Zambia, Caritas Zambia, and the many people who are marching on Saturday to ask for global solidarity, but much more to say people come first before profits and other concerns. The moment we remove morality from economics, then we put profits before people. But the call, the resounding call on Saturday was that, you know, people before profits. At the end of each economic decision, there is somebody who's going to suffer, and that's a person. And therefore, we should always think that people suffer, and the poorest suffer more than others when we make certain decisions. And I think this fundamental call from the Holy Father is appropriate, that we cannot carry on business as usual. We have to put global social justice at the basis of the way we relate in terms of trade, the way we relate in terms of making decision, economic decisions that affect the people, and also the role of international institutions, that they should have this sense of justice as their major concern as they make agreements that affect the world economy.
Thanks there to Father Joe Koma Koma, the Secretary General of the Zambian Bishops' Conference, talking to my colleague Chris Altieri. That's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at the same time tomorrow or find us online at www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.